global phenomenon, Surviving the Survivor, where we bring you the best guests in all of true crime.
What's up, SDS Nation, and welcome to another episode of Surviving the Survivor, the podcast that promises to bring you the very best guests in all of true crime. And as I look at our panel tonight, I realize once again, it is not a tagline. It is our reality. I just muted the guests because there's always, we were talking about technology and it is not perfected yet. There's a little weird audio glitch. So I'm going to unmute them and then I'll have them mute themselves once I'm done. But New York police appear to have cracked a 13-year-old cold case. Accused Long Island serial killer Rex Huerman's DNA is now reportedly being cross-examined against Las Vegas cold case victim Victoria Camara and a few others. Recently, another victim, Karen Vergata, was identified. We had Othram, people from the company Othram on who discussed that, and they're helping to solve some of these cases. So there are a few questions. Are these cold cases warming up? Is the case against Rex Huerman getting stronger? Is there a forensic frenzy in full effect? And Joe Scott can answer that one for us. He is our best guest. Joseph Scott Morgan is the Distinguished Scholar of Applied Forensics at Jacksonville State University. He is considered one of the leading experts on the coroner system in all of the United States. He was a senior investigator for the Fulton County, for Fulton County for close to 15 years and hosts his own podcast, one of my favorite names, Body Bags with Joseph Scott Morgan, and I'm going to beg him for a hat at Crime Con. We're just talking about how I'm going to see him there. Then you've got Mac. Like Oprah, there's certain people, it's just one word, Mac. And there she is, Cheryl Mac McCollum. She is an Emmy Award-winning CSI, part of CBS 46 in Atlanta, the director of the Cold Case Investigative Research Unit Institute, a writer for Crime Online. This goes on a long time. I know she just had Nancy Grace on her podcast. She's a co-author of the textbook Cold Case Pathways to Justice. And then the man you see every Friday, getting in on the action a little more lately, Scott Duffy is director of Wilmington University's Criminal Justice Institute. He's a retired FBI supervisory special agent of the Wilmington office, where he worked filing crime matters, gangs, bank robberies, and the Fugitive Task Force for 20 years. Prior to the FBI, he served the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania as a police officer for 5.5 years. A quick programming note. We did a Maui fundraiser on Sunday night, and all the merchandise, and I'm unmuting you guys. If you guys can mute yourselves, I would appreciate that, and then we'll unmute as you go. But we did a Maui fundraiser, and everything sold in our store through Thursday night, and the link, the COE will put that up, the chief of everything, but everything sold in the store from this past Sunday through Thursday night will all go to the great people of Hawaii, specifically to Maui, to the Hawaii Community Foundation. It is called Maui Strong, and they're handling, they're doing a lot of the work on the ground to get the people what they need, and we are doing our small part. We're talking about Rex Huerman today. These people know it better than anyone else. I like to always think of the victims. The Gilgo Beach Four, the ones attributed right now to Rex Huerman. You have Melissa Barthelemy, 24, Amber Lynn Costello, 22, Megan Waterman, 27. And Rex Huerman is a prime suspect in the murder of Maureen Brainerd Barnes, who was 25 years old. Mac, this has been on my mind since I saw this tweet. And just so the audience knows, Joe Scott, a busy man, who everyone wants a piece of, has got to hop off at 7:50. So we're going to get to him right after I go to Mac on this. But Mac, you tweeted this out over a week ago, but it is stuck in my mind about the positioning of the victims. And mm-hmm. You had a very interesting take. I think they were all pointing maybe north, but can you explain what you were saying in that tweet?
Well, that's what we've heard. And if that's the case, if you look at the maps of where their bodies are found, they're real close together and they're lined up side by side with spacing in between. And if they're all facing the same direction, it occurred to me that architects sketch drawings and plans just like I do a crime scene, with north being your guidepost. And it almost looked to me, if you, again, you just take the maps from New Jersey and New York, it looks like they're all lined up on a little roadway and it could possibly be a little town. So it just popped in my head. I couldn't quit thinking about it. So I put it out there.
And, but you also talked about how, you know, him being an architect, you know, he was literally like designing his own architecture, right?
Yeah, because again, he would do a drawing just like I would, with North being your central, you know, focal point. And if that's the case, if you just turn the map, it starts to make sense to you that that's in a very twisted way what it could be. Because you've got a little roadway, then you've got your buildings, which in this case would be bodies. And see, that's New York, what you're putting up now. But if you were to also put up New Jersey, it's the same. There's a small roadway, and then they're lined up like buildings.
Scott Duffy, I lied. I said we were going right to Joe Scott, but you're the investigator extraordinaire here. What do you make of this from Cheryl Mack McCollum, that maybe he lined the bodies up specifically, and serial killers are known to have little weird nuances, and he's an architect. Is that something you look at?
Yeah, everything is on the table. So, you know, and when you're gathering around what we would call a war room, you have plenty of ideas where people are thinking of things, theorizing, you're throwing it up on the board. It's something to think about and definitely plays into what could be once someone's identified into an interview room. So you want to gather as much as you can. And then when you are interviewing somebody who is your suspect, you have all these thoughts, these ideas, these theories that come through all the experts that have guided the investigation, and you just start laying the groundwork, and you'll get a reaction, whether the suspect is you're way out of line, or they're just looking at you and saying, wow, so you get me. So it's a great tool to use to see what works in the interview room and what doesn't. So absolutely, every theory is on the table until it's proven otherwise.
Maybe the guilty culprit, because it's always the last one logging on. Joe Scott, very broadly, there's so much going on. I mean, we've got these sets of 11 you know, humans on the beach, on Gilgo Beach. But now there's cases that they're looking at, you know, possibly in New Jersey. There's something I'm going to get to news-wise about South Carolina today, Vegas. Yeah. From a forensic standpoint, just can you paint a sort of broad stroke picture of what is going on forensically speaking right now?
Yeah, well, first off, thanks for having me this evening. From a broad construct, I think that from an investigative construct, I think that it's going to be important that you have a centralized investigation with this, where you're going to have a central upload point for all of this data, where, and it's going to be copious amounts of data coming in from these cold cases. If you can just imagine a room filled with files, just endlessly. Vegas itself, you know, the number of cases that they deal with out there, from a cold case perspective, unidentifieds, those sorts of things, would, you know, make mighty men quake in their boots alone. Then you couple that with all these other geographically diverse locations. Then, you know, from a medical legal standpoint, you know, some of the stuff that we look for are the causal effects of death. You know, what, you know, we've heard, I think that Dr. Bodden opined, at least in one of the cases from Gilgo Beach, that it's his opinion that this was a manual strangulation, at least in one of the cases. And the problem is this, is that by the time they have gotten to these bodies, they're so compromised through decompositional change and disbursement of remains, perhaps through animal activity or waterborne conditions, that it's going to be really hard. And one of the things that you look for in serialized events is commonality in behaviors relative to the body. Y'all had mentioned just a few moments ago, you know, kind of the positionality when it comes down to the deposition of the remains. that's certainly important because, you know, you can develop a pattern, you know, vis-a-vis that. But then you also look for patterns in the cause of death. You know, how did these people come to an end? Are these sharp force events? Are these strangulations? Are they ligature deaths? And the absence of, say, for instance, soft tissue on many of these remains, it's really hard to ascertain that. And when you're talking about manual strangulation, you know, our default position in the medical legal world is we always look for that tiny bone, the hyoid. And it's one of the first bones to disappear, you know, particularly through animal activity. Because I think over the course of my career, when I was still with a coroner in New Orleans, I saw one case over my years down there that was not a manual strangulation where the individual died and they had a fractured hyoid. And that's a guy that went over a railing in like a 1969 Pontiac, was not belted, and fell like three stories and impacted in on his throat with a steering wheel. And that's the only time I've ever seen a fractured hyoid outside of a manual strangulation. They used to happen with judicial hangings, but we don't have those anymore. So, you know, you look for those sorts of things. I'm sorry to go so far afield, but the dynamics of this, the information is so dense, particularly from a scientific standpoint, that it's very important that it remain very well ordered. And one final point for me, there's a huge sigh of relief, I think, that the chief has taken over with the Gilgo Beach case. And he's done a fine job to this point of kind of organizing the task force and compiling all of this data in a relatively short period of time, Joel, given the depth and breadth, the years that are involved in all of these cases. He's done a fine job. I hope that he'll continue to be the lead and his task force will be the lead in all of these cases.
And Joe Scott, just to follow up, and I have a million follow-ups, but just, I think I asked Mac this the last time she was on, the other remains that have not been tied to him necessarily, do you think over time they will be? Is it even possible from a forensic standpoint at this point, because you're talking about degradation over time, will they be able to prove that if he did commit these crimes, that, you know, that he's responsible through science?
Yeah, here's a key for me. It's just my opinion. In some of these cases, we've got issues involving dismemberment. I think that our friends, perhaps, in tool mark section, particularly with the FBI, are going to play a key role in this. This one young lady whose remains were found, I think that she was victim, I can't recall which one, I actually did part of my podcast on her death. The body was found, or the legs were found in Fire Island, but yet her head was actually found not too far away at Gilgo. And so you've got this issue of dismemberment that comes into place. And that's different, isn't it? When you think about it, when you begin to think about the nature of who takes a life, when you have them being wrapped in, say, burlap and being deposited, as Mac talked about, you know, where they're kind of all in a row, but yet you have these events where dismemberment takes place. Is there connectivity with him? And are there any tools that he would have utilized in order to facilitate that? Well, that can be assessed perhaps through tool marks that are left behind on the bone. They would have needed a quiet, sequestered place, probably with a power source, unless he's using a, you know, like a carpenter saw. But if he's using a skill saw or an electric chainsaw, or maybe he's using a gas chainsaw, who knows? I've seen all manner of them. But still, he would need a secluded location. This is not something he's going to do probably in the back of his Avalanche, if you will. Someplace where he would be protected while he goes about his business of dismembering. And it's a big change, isn't it, when you think about that, where you have intact bodies that are wrapped. We refer to this as cocooning of the remains, to dismembered remains, which the deposition is kind of odd. You know, I think back to the discovery of those legs at Fire Island. And I think, wow, can you imagine being that couple and they're kind of walking along, you know, the marsh line, the beach, that area in there, and they look over and it's in the bay and they see this bag that's kind of cracked open, if memory serves me correctly. And, you know, these two legs are essentially poking out of there. What a striking thing to find. But yet the fact that her head was such a long, long way, Joel, from those legs is quite amazing.
Yeah. And she's Jane Doe number 7, who was identified through author and Karen Vergata. Got to remember the victims. So important to put names to those faces. I was going to come to this next, but since I am not T-Pain, a friend of the show, by the way, Tali from Israel, a friend of the show, said hello as well. She claimed I did not call her a friend of the show, so I'm now stressing that she's, in fact, a friend of the show. But I am not T-Pain is asking a question, and this is a little inside baseball if you haven't been following the case closely, but does the arrest of James Burke give Rex's defense attorneys extra ammunition to use during trial to cast reasonable doubt? Will this help Rex? So what I am not T-Pain is talking about, this news broke today. This is the ex-Suffolk County police chief. He had been accused many times of botching this investigation. He actually went to federal prison for beating someone up who they had in custody back in, I think, 2012. Well, he was arrested today for soliciting a male for sex on in Long Island. He was picked up by the Suffolk County police department, who he used to lead around 10:15 this morning. To you, Mac, what does this do for the case, if anything at all? But I think it does give potentially ammunition to defense attorneys who are going to say, look, this guy was leading this investigation. We don't know what else this guy was doing.
Well, I'm not an attorney, but I can tell you any defense attorney should use anything that comes their way. And this is a gift. So this shows that not only was this guy corrupt then, because he already went to prison, he still is. And he is soliciting the very pool of people that are the serial killer's victims. So you've got a lot of things that they're going to, I'm sure, be unpacking in the next week or two. And there's no doubt in my mind they are dancing in the street, honey.
I don't know about you, Scott Duffy, but I hear Joe Scott and Mac talk, and I feel so uncivilized because I'm from the Northeast. I feel like, I don't know what I feel like other than uncivilized. But Scott Duffy, you're certainly not. You're somewhere halfway in between, Scott Duffy, a little closer than me. But does this, this really puts a black eye on law enforcement. I mean, this guy was literally the chief of Suffolk County PD. Was arrested and sent to prison for beating up a guy named Chris Loeb, who was in police custody. And that guy stole, allegedly, sex toys from this chief, which is kind of crazy. And years later now, he's arrested for soliciting a male in a park by his same police department. It kind of cast a black eye, if anything, on the police department, right?
Oh, definitely a black eye. Any time a police officer, current or retired, is arrested, is absolutely cast tarnish on the badge. And it's always a shame that anyone in law enforcement would subject themselves. But ultimately, yes, especially in law enforcement, when one does something, everyone feels the domino effect. But with regards to the actual case, it all comes down to what did the chief do during his time at the department. So if he had access to anything in the evidence room, if he actually supervised any crime scenes, if he showed up at crime scenes, if he's on a chain of custody of anything, then there will definitely be issues that the defense can raise. But as a commanding, as a chief, if he's not a part of any of those aspects of the investigations, the prosecution can keep him off a witness list and leave it up to the defense to introduce that and, call him themselves if they want. But it's absolutely a shame for all of law enforcement when any particular officer is arrested.
Especially when I'm interviewing. I did, I think it'll be out this Friday. By the way, quick programming note, I'm sad to announce, no Great Scott, It's Your True Crime Phil this Friday, because yours truly is being dragged to a wedding. But instead, we're going to have Detective Phil Ramos Las Vegas Police Department, a veteran detective, retired now, told me some crazy stories, part of the series Surviving My Biggest Case. That will be out Friday. The COE is working on that as we speak. And a shout out to Laura Coulston, who became a YouTube member, and Susan B. here for saying hit that like button. We appreciate that. So, Joe Scott, back to you. As the clock ticks, I want to get as much out of your brain as I can. So now we pivot to South Carolina, getting closer to your guys' accent. Friends of a woman who vanished in South Carolina 6 years ago are now pleading with police to investigate Rex Huerman and the disappearance. This woman's name is Julia Ann Bean, and she was the mom of three, and she went missing on November 18th, 2017. At the time, she was, as I said, a 36-year-old mom of three. Interestingly, she was struggling with addiction. She had not been seen for more than 6 months, and her best friend has now come forward saying that she has a real gut feeling here, and apparently people around this woman somehow got some sort of description that seems to fit what is Rex Huerman's potential physicality. In terms of forensics, again, because that's what will solve these cases, what can authorities do now with the remains, and I believe they have them, of this woman who went missing, Julia Ann Bean?
A lot of that is going to, and this is kind of stating the obvious, but what was the status? What were the status of those remains when they were recovered? What location were they recovered from? And how were they treated? One point I'd like to make, and as grotesque as it is, the bodies being wrapped in burlap, that goes to an idea that we discuss sometimes called memorialization of the dead. I've had cases before where people are just simply dumped on the side of the road. But to take time to wrap a body up in their own twisted way, this methodology that's being utilized, it speaks a lot about the individual. And one of the things that you look for from just the physical evidence standpoint is how were the remains treated? Do you have someone that is acting out post-mortem fantasies with the remains, posing the remains? I worked a series of serial killings, again, when I was still in New Orleans, along the I-10 corridor down there. These cases stretched all the way from, I think, Jacksonville, Florida to roughly Corpus Christi, Texas, I think. And the victims were always nude, with the exception of underwear turned inside out, and posed very similar to the position of that classic Leonardo da Vinci rendering of man, you know, with the arms extended out like this. And that is a signature that you look for. And I know that that's a well-worn term, but you look for those commonalities at the scene. And then most of the time with these individuals, they have a preference for their method of killing. It's something that they work out in their mind as to how they achieve this gratification that they have. Most of these things have some kind of sexual component. Firing a firearm in somebody is not necessarily going to elicit the same feeling within them as it does when they wrap their hands around someone's throat and they feel them struggling beneath them. So we're looking for those sorts of things. It's just, you have to be very careful in these cases, because I've seen cases like this where you wind up on a wild goose chase because people think that the case might very well be associated with an individual that has been named in other cases. So I would argue for due care as they, you know, examine this case. I certainly wouldn't take him off of the roster of suspects, particularly given the proximity, and I don't know it, honest to God, to this property that I think he and his brother possess in South Carolina. Look for that sort of thing, that commonality, that geographic commonality. Would he have had access to the deposition sites? Those sorts of things. And if I remember correctly, there was another young woman that may have been missing down there as well. Are there any similarities with deposition, memorialization of the body? Were they attempting to hide the body? Was there a partial burial? Or were they just cast on the side of the road like the ones at Gilgo Beach?
And that's it, by the way. L. Rose, love the name. Loving Zone 7, that is Mac's podcast. And L. Rose weighing in. Tali in Israel saying she's thinking about giving forgiveness because Detective Ramos will ease the pain of not having the Friday fix with Scott and Phil. So
can I jump in just a second?
Mac, anytime you want to jump in, you jump in.
Well, a lot of emphasis is being put on the bodies, which it should be. But when that young woman in South Carolina went missing, if they worked this as a homicide, it could very well be her phone records are in that file. If they can match a phone to her phone log to the suspect we have in Long Island, that's a money trade. And he probably kept the same phone for 20 years, the work phone anyway, right? These burner phones, however he has moved them in and out and how he's added, you know, minutes and all that, it seems like he's kept the phones themselves. He also has emails attached. So again, if they communicated first by email and then he contacted her with a burner phone and they collected all of that, they still have it and can cross-check what New York has. That's just one element. And there's other, but that's one, I tell you.
And that seems like a very smart one and an obvious one, which I wasn't even thinking of, but that's why I'm not an investigator. But Mac, back to you. So this friend of Julia Ann being the woman, the 36-year-old mom of three from South Carolina, her name, the friend's name is Heidi Kovas, and she's been campaigning to raise awareness ever since the disappearance. And again, she said earlier in a different news report that she had a gut feeling after seeing the arrest of Rex Huerman that it was, in fact, him. And, you know, Joe Scott was talking about similarities with the bodies, and there are similarities with the victimology. And this friend said all of them match Julia, meaning all these victims whose sketches or photos she saw matched her friend Julia. Everything, the blonde hair, the green eyes, the fact she was so petite, and also how she disappeared so suddenly. She had $5,000 in the bank. She had money in her purse, but she did not take that with her. Her drugs were left on the table. So the MO, there's a lot of similarities here, Mac. I don't know. Does it make it, after hearing that, does it make the impulse to investigate this even stronger for you?
Are you kidding? Yes. I'm telling you, I would want two separate war rooms. I would want the one wall to be the victims that we knew for sure. There's a linkage in geography and MO and signatures and some of the DNA that's already come back. That's what I want. The cell phones, everything. Then I've got the wall over here where they feel like it. I got that same gut feeling about these victims. And I think it maybe some point down the road, we're going to be able to take these victims and put them over here in a larger group. Then I've got a wall behind me. I don't know how they fit, if they fit. But I would be derelict in my duty if I didn't look at them, if I didn't put them on the board. Because I want to remind everybody about Gabby Petito. How many other people were found in that desert looking for her? So even if we're looking for somebody that's not tied to the Long Island serial killer, so what? If they're tied to somebody else, that means we get two killers off the street. I'm good with that all day. So I say everybody makes this board, and one by one, let's rule them in or rule them out. That'd be one less person to worry about. The Middlemans, they have a mantra, and it's one less. There's one less killer. There's one less rapist. There's one less person that's going to kidnap you and assault you and hack you up and throw you in the brush. I'm good with that. I'm happy with that. One less, baby.
That's a great point. It's a great title for a podcast, One Less. Speaking of the podcast titles, Hope, Hate, Fear, Body Bag, Zone 7 with the applause emoji. If you guys haven't listened to Joe Scott Morgan's podcast, check it out. Best name. I love it. Body Bags. Mac, you are awesome, from Chelsea Whitaker. Scott Duffy, you're not bad yourself. So investigators down in South Carolina were asked about this. And the quote, and I will give you a direct quote, Scott Duffy. This is your world. He said, "We're going to be looking into it on our end from the county where this happened." To that point, to that end, Scott Duffy, this woman, best friend, comes forward, says her best friend went missing, similar circumstances, similar appearance, you know, victimology sort of checks out. If you're running this sheriff's office or whatever jurisdiction this is in South Carolina, Scott Duffy, what do you do? What's your first step?
Yeah, so the most important thing that it's an active investigation, right? So you're always, and if everything went, and Matt's exactly right, are you investigating as a missing person or are you investigating as a homicide? So that changes resources, that changes the direction, that changes the energy for the investigators involved. But at the same time, so Rex is identified. He is now internationally known. So everyone is focused in on seeing how the prosecution's going to lay out and what other homicides are going to be attributed to him. And then, of course, you have, you know, the Atlantic City homicides. You have elsewhere where Rex may have been either residing, vacationing, work, whatever, that brings him to a place where if you have similarities, just as has already been told, you're going to take a look at it. But at the same time, the investigators involved hopefully have good ideas, and their case hasn't become national spotlight, which for them may be good because they get to really dig down deep and go through each and every piece of evidence that they may have that's going to lead them. So for example, if they have the phone records, but they had nothing to go to, now that you have the Gilboa Beach homicides and these burner phones and his phones that are now on the radar, law enforcement's going to share that information, and they're going to say, "Hey, here's a key number. Here's this." And this happened in many of my cases where you're looking for key pieces of information, and then something happens, and like that's something similar to mine. Can you get a hold of an investigator to see if we can grab a piece of information that's not out in the news that we can run down our own search? For example, a phone number. So the investigators in South Carolina are going to do their own search warrants. They're going to track everything down, try to make a connection. And if the connection is not there, you know, they're going to put it in a file and wait till something else comes out, whether it be a DNA hit from this or that, you know. So it's all being shared. But at the same time, we don't know what all these different similar cases look like for the investigators, and that, you know, they could already be going down a path. They might have already ruled out anything from the Gilboa Beach and have their own ideas. So it's definitely on their radar, but and the sheriff has to make sure that the investigators have what they need and moving forward on their case.
And it's getting incredibly complicated in short order, just trying to juggle different states, different, victims popping up. It is a lot. And for the life of me, I do not understand how law enforcement can organize it all. But you got better minds like Mac and Joe Scott and Scott to explain it to me. Misdemeanor. This is something that's been on my mind, Joe Scott. Burlap bags. I was going to ask you before if it's intentional, and there's a lot of specificity with serial killers. So she writes, burlap bags, all for quicker decomposition. Holes in the material allow air, water to get body and facilitate decomposition. That's the reason. Is she onto something here, Joe Scott?
Perhaps. There are other items that would inhibit, certainly other types of cloth that the body could be wrapped in that would perhaps slow the process of decomposition, forgive me, but not too much. Obviously, if you have a body that's wrapped in plastic, for instance, that's a big no-no in our field. because of humidity and those sorts of things in the interior of a bag, for instance. That's why we don't put plastic bags on hands, for instance. But, you know, there's a broader, you know, kind of a broader issue here for those. And this is kind of a brief kind of history lesson. Burlap is actually, it can be made from any number of things and has been for thousands of years. But primarily here in the States and other places, it's made of a plant called jute, J-U-T-E. And for those that are familiar with biblical history, there's a term that's used for mourning. It's called the wearing of sackcloth and covering yourself in ashes. Well, sackcloth is actually burlap. I find that very, very interesting. Now, I don't know if there's any connectivity, but when it comes to somebody that is serializing crime, you take nothing for granted. They're generally, everything is like some damn Japanese tea ceremony, you know, where everything seems like it has meaning to it, every motion, everything. And when it becomes repetitive in particular, now we could just simply say, well, he's a duck hunter. It was camouflage. It's what he had access to. Well, yeah, but he's an architect. I would assume that he had a few pennies to rub together. He's living in Long Island, granted, in an old dilapidated house, but a house that he didn't pay for any longer. Why burlap? Why would you choose that in particular? So that's kind of interesting. Burlap is not particularly absorbent, for instance. If you're, you know, it's going to leak. If you have bloodied someone and you try to wrap a body in burlap, it's still going to leak. It's going to leave something behind on any kind of contact surface that body would be laid upon. So I don't really understand the utility of it. I guess you could say that the burlap would increase the possibility of camouflaging. Remember, this is a camouflage, according to what we've heard, camouflage pattern. So maybe it's that simple. But again, I don't, when, you know, you have authorities that are looking into this and they have specifically identified this individual as a serial perpetrator, I think that everything has to be considered in this.
Starry Crystal Knight, glad to catch a live, especially with Mac, and an insight into my world right here. I'm going to bring up this comment just to see what I deal with. Barbara Hamilton, picking your guest brains is revolting. Please clean up your vernacular, Joel. Barbara, I'm from New Jersey. A lot worse has been said. I'm not refined like our Southern guests, but I will make a mental note of that, and I will try to use more polite language in how I refer to things. And there is Space Coast, our chief mod right there. Hi, y'all. I'm worried because Joe Scott's running out soon, and the guy's got an amazing mind for this. So my friend Dan Bowens at Fox 5 in New York actually put an article out today and kind of recapped some of the DNA evidence. He talked about the bodies being found in burlap. Five hairs were found on three victims. They were degraded, these hairs, but they were not discarded. And then the discussion of mitochondrial DNA came into this story. And he had a quote from an expert named Cynthia Kale, a forensic expert. And she says, there's so much more mitochondrial DNA per cell than there is nuclear DNA. And because of the structure, the mitochondrial DNA, it's circular. So it's self-contained. So it's protected better from environmental factors. Basically, Joe Scott, in a roundabout way, I wanted to see if you could, in sort of layman's terms, explain this DNA hit using mitochondrial DNA and the pizza crust, just using forensics. How did they kind of come full circle back to Rex Huerman?
Yeah, I think that the mitochondrial DNA is going to be a separate set, perhaps, than the pizza crust. The pizza crust, it was a confirmatory event, and kudos to the officers that were sitting on this guy just to watch. I mean, what a piece of work to sit there and take your time surveilling this guy, watching him dump that crust, and then rushing over there to get it. And I know that there are brighter minds in mind when it comes to the legal finer points here. You know, if you discard something, and, you know, even if it has evidentiary value, you no longer, you're saying essentially before the court, you know, the court would, you know, would hold that, you know, you have no interest in this any longer. So, you know, you have no rights when it comes to this. They can retrieve it, and that's what happened. And, of course, they confirmed that with a cheek swab. You go back to the mitochondrial DNA. And what's fascinating to me about this, these hairs that are found, Joel, are the association with a wife. And I've seen several comments, and I don't respond to these but you know, people are opining that, you know, she may have had knowledge or involvement and all these sorts of things. And I don't know that there's necessarily any kind of connectivity like that. But from a physical standpoint, when you're finding her hairs associated, you know, contained on the burlap bag, and they're there, that's a point of confluence with the home in which he indwelled with her. They're both domiciled there. And this idea, and this is very sinister, I think, the idea that did they come in contact with these hairs, the victims, they being the victims, as a result of being in the truck, a space that she may have occupied, or be inside the domicile. You know, and I find it interesting. You know, one of the things that came along was the idea that one of the investigators, the team had put forward that at least one of the victims may have died in that home. Well, what kind of evidence do you have of that? What is it that you're, what's the driver behind that? And, you know, that's left to be found out. They'll reveal that in due course. To mitochondrial DNA, though, it is rather robust. It's self-contained. Whereas, you know, if you had this much richer sample, say, for instance, that had come from a hair root or from a blood sample, yeah, it is more rich. You don't have to do quite the amplification with it that you do with mitochondrial, but it persists. And that's the important part here. This brings us full circle back to the idea that these remains, which for me are central relative to the information that they contain, are greatly degraded. I'm just talking about from a decompositional standpoint. But yet you have those single strands of hair that contain so much information, and they found them there. I'm curious to see how much more is recovered relative to biological evidence that can tie Huerman back to these victims and to potentially that scene.
Analytical Blarney, AB. I could listen to Joseph Scott Morgan's voice all day, every day. It's like Keith Morrison or Morgan Freeman. That is quite the compliment, quite the family to be a part of right there. Michelina Serino, in my opinion, Mac, there's more than one killer on Long Island. I have no doubt about that myself. But bigger point, which I think we discussed last time, Mac, the other sets of remains at Gilgo Beach. Do you think that Rex Huerman, if he's a killer, is also responsible for those in your gut?
Well, let's take it one at a time. And this is going to go for South Carolina, Nevada, New York, and New Jersey for right now. Rex Huerman, we know for a fact, was on the grid. He bought a burner phone with an American Express card. In Nevada, he had timeshare. If you have a timeshare, you've got to go through the management office, pick your week, go in there and check in. Like, you are so on the grid, they're going to know exactly when he was there and when he wasn't. He had to buy gasoline to get to South Carolina. He bought airline tickets to go to Iceland. So we know, for example, with Melissa, her phone was active till August 9th or something, and it cut off. He leaves for Iceland. He gets back on the 12th or something. Her phone goes right back active. That's a money tree. And we also know that his cell phone and the burner phones went together. So everywhere that burner phone, sure enough, there was Rex. And here's another thing that I want people to understand, just how twisted this cat is. When it comes to what he was doing at work, what he was researching, who he was contacted by email, who he was contacted by phone, all of these sex workers. He's researching tinks and child porn and torture porn while at work. This wasn't something he only did at home. His daughter worked with him. So his daughter is sitting, what, 5 feet, 8 feet at another desk? that's the man you're dealing with. So it always fascinates me when people say, well, I knew he had an affair, but I didn't think he would do whatever. Listen to me. A cheater is a cheater is a cheater. If he cheats on you, he can cheat on his taxes. He's going to cheat at work, etc. If he thinks he can get away with having an affair, then he thinks he can get away with a sex worker. And he thinks he can get away with pornography. And he thinks he can get away with other things that would blow your mind. So if you think about how fast law enforcement put out his research list, they did that on purpose so that we would understand who we're dealing with.
I love law enforcement with all my heart, but sometimes I feel bad for the children. Imagine being Max's kids and she's got a hold of your cell phone, man. She's going through that cell phone like something out of a CSI scene. Same with Scott Duffy. Nothing's getting by his four kids. No way, no how. Scott Duffy, to you from L. Rose, I'm probably going to get heat because I haven't come to you as much, and I always get yelled at for not going to you more, Scott Duffy. Anyone noticed, this was not what I was going to ask you, but since L. Rose brought this up, I noticed this, L. Rose. Did anyone notice two of the girls have the same pose in their photos, one from Gilgo and one from Vegas? Both have the hand under the chin. Are these Craigslist pictures? Scott Duffy, if you're an investigator on this case, they're remarkably similar pictures. At one point, I almost thought that they were the same. Is that going to catch your attention? Are you going to do a double take and say, wait, is this guy targeting these women who are even posing in similar manners?
Yes. And so not only are they posing in similar manners, but they're very, as you had just said, hey, that they look like the same picture. So we are looking at someone that is targeting a very similar, what gets him going? What is driving him to target? Because there are a lot of different type of sex workers, and it's not just, oh, there's five women, 10 women. Or if it was another, males and so forth, but he is targeting a very specific type. What gets him going? Not only just like in regular life. I mean, what attracts somebody to somebody else? And so just because now I'm a serial killer and I'm targeting what I am attracted to. So it would not surprise me at all that you would find these type of similarities in the victims, especially victims who have no connection to each other, do not know each other. And so how is he targeting them through an online website? And so all that's being backtracked by law enforcement. And then so let's say now you have those photos that are attributed to his victims, it also allows other potential victims missing or whatnot in these other key areas that he had been to see it, that's an easy go-to for an investigator to say, hey, I have a name. Can we see if that person also was on this particular website now that we have, potentially two hits? So it's definitely useful.
And Lisa Rybakov, a friend of the show and a best guest on the show, we're going to get her back on. Two girls, she's out on Long Island. Two girls are missing from a 15-mile radius from the brother's property. We'll get back to that. But Joe Scott, I've got about a minute, 30 seconds. I got to get one more question in. As we know, the judge ordered Rex Huerman against his defense's wishes to provide another DNA swab. What's that going to do, in your opinion, for the case overall? I'm sure they've already gotten it. Is it going to be entered into CODIS? And I bring it up because we are covering a case right now of Rachel Morin, a mother of five who was basically bludgeoned to death on a hiking trail in Maryland. And they got a CODIS hit, but they don't have an identity on the suspect. So there's basically a nationwide manhunt at this point for this guy to try to get him off the streets. But is it possible that they're going to enter this into CODIS and get a hit, and maybe it's Rex Huerman's, but he was never identified?
Traditionally CODIS was structured so that there were two separate categories. You had a forensic section or an unknown section where you were collecting DNA samples from scenes that, you know, where there was some kind of biological deposition there, and you had no one to tie it back to. And then, of course, you have the offender portion of that. Yeah, I suppose that they could enter it and see if he pops up anywhere else. I think more broadly, I'm fascinated. I'll be very fascinated to see with this buckle, this latest sampling that they took from him, what they have in these other geographic areas to see if there's any kind of match with these. I would imagine that there's a lot hinging on this. They wanted to get a valid sample from him again, for whatever reason. I have no idea, just to make sure that all of the bases were covered and that it was viable, a confirmatory sample, for instance, and to see, you know, what's going on nationally. Is there anything else out there that it can be plugged into that maybe they're going to get a hit on? It'll be interesting to see how this plays out down the road.
Joe Scott, I want you to stay on, but it's 50:43 after the hour, and I know you got to get going. So we'd love to have you. Appreciate
you. Thank you. I'm humbled that you guys would have me. Thank you so much. I hope everybody has a fantastic evening.
Excited to meet you at CrimeCon. Have a great one, Joe Scott.
Yes, sir. Take care.
Dom's mom, Mac, and we're going to go a little while longer since now I have two great brains, and I won't use the P word with that again. Don't want to upset any STS Nation members. Dom's mom, 725. Her son has the same birthday as me, so you know he's a cool kid. Another question. Do we know anything about his brother and or if he's been or being investigated too? He has the same vehicle, and they were supposedly pretty close, right? And then this comment from Lucy Bell, Mac. What are the odds Rex Heuermann and his brother are both killers who acted independently of one another? That's a very interesting question. I'm afraid to hear your answer, Mac.
Here's my answer, and it's the same answer that I gave a while back. The moment they released that belt, I said, there is no way family members do not recognize that belt. There's no way. If that was the grandfather's belt, if that's his grandfather's belt, his brother knew it. They grew up. That was either the disciplinary belt. That was something he wore every day. There's some connection to that belt. That's why Rex has it. That's why he used it with that victim. He just left it behind. It was an accident. He didn't do that on purpose. But that belt, for his wife, for his brother, nobody recognized it, especially the brother. It's hard for me to believe. I thought the minute they released it, this thing was going to start cooking with grease, because they're not only going to recognize it, somebody may come forward. There should be DNA on it. The buckle, leather can absorb. If you have anything that's leather, you know, you can treat it with certain things and it'll absorb that ointment. So I don't know that there's not more evidence attributed to that. I would want the buckle myself. I would want to undo it a little bit and, you know, get in them grooves and see if we can find any DNA. But again, just the visual aspect, as soon as you knew it, it was an older looking item. You knew it was like 60s or 70s. So again, it wasn't a big leap to me that should have had somebody come forward if that was what they would want to do. And that's all I'll say about it.
Let me ask you this. Is Joe Scott as nice and sweet and smart as he seems on the YouTube as he is in real life, Mac?
More so. I will tell you, he is one of the most giving and caring and just, I will be there in a heartbeat kind of friend. You don't even have to call him and tell him you need something. He's going to call and offer it. There's nothing but remarkable things I can say about him. Nothing.
Mac, I have a feeling he would say the same about you. And Scott Duffy, I would say the same about you.
I would too, Scott.
From Iris Hewlett, and this might be out of your purview here, Scott Duffy, but I'm curious, can they determine, this is a Joe Scott question, the actual time of, or maybe a Mac question, the actual time of death from skeletal remains? Is that even possible, Scott?
Yeah, that I would not know. So, Mac?
Mac?
The short answer is it depends. So, if you have bones that were just on top of the ground. You're going to look for things like how bleached are they with the sun, how much animal activity, you know, if everything is gone, all the skin, you know, most of the hair, all the ligaments, everything, you can start to kind of guess. If they've been buried, it's a little bit harder, but you can still do it. Here's the best answer. They can date dinosaurs, so they can, you know, surely date one of us. So yes, they can do it. There's a lot they can do to determine a reasonable date. Does that make sense?
Mac, you might know this answer too. Love Zone 7, any updates from Alabama on Peach's identity? She's the woman with the tattoo of the peach. Do you know anything about that, Mac? Because I do not.
I believe that Peaches is going to be next. I've been very vocal about that. Again, if you look at the map, I think Peaches and the Asian male are going to be the next that are going to be identified. Because if this was my case, those would be the ones that I would be pushing. Because again, I want that order. I want to be able to say, boom, 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 boom. Now give me that timeline. When did they go missing? When did they go missing? When did they go missing? Because we've all thought this has been since 2010. Well, now we know from another victim, this is probably 1996. Is it going to go back further? I think we got to be patient. This is not going to be a quick thing. Is anybody in New Jersey going to be involved? Massachusetts, Rhode Island, South Carolina, Nevada? You got to be patient. My gut tells me, yeah. I say all the time, there's no such thing as a part-time serial killer. There's no such thing as a part-time rapist. There's not. This is what this man did all the time. People make fun and they say, but for an architect, his house is being propped up by a 2x4 because he doesn't care about the house. He doesn't care about it. He cares about raping and killing. The setup, of course, these women all look alike. And if I had to guess, once he makes contact with them through the email, and then moves to the cell phone, then moves to the meeting, he's got a playbook. How they respond to him is how he connects. That's how he selects her. He starts killing her 2 weeks before they ever meet. He's already got it playing in his head. And I bet he's got something that he says. And the way she says something back to him, it's her. So let's just say for argument's sake, he asked for a half and half or around the world. If she says, I'll do both for $75, you're it. Because you remember what he said to Melissa's sister? He said, your sister's a whore. So he doesn't care anything about him. He's angry. He's playing a game. He called her family 5 times. That's where he's at, y'all. This is a different level of twisted.
I'm as a son of a psychiatrist and a social worker, I want to know what was going on in that house he's lived in his whole life when he was a little boy into his teen years. But that's
the belt is a clue. I'm straight up telling you, he was probably horribly abused.
Yeah. And for those of you who don't know what Mac's talking about, there have been belts found at some of the scenes with the initials of what we believe are his father or grandfather, potentially. And those Mac believes are clues. And I would not be surprised to find out he was being smacked around with those. Big shout out to friends of the show, Nightwood, Old Lady Snoop, Chelsea Whitaker, The Advocate, Bundy Data, and Baby Doll, all back to back in the comments. Andolin, have any of you considered, by the way, I always say best guest in the business, which is true, but better community. No offense to the guests. You guys have great questions tonight. Have any of you considered competing offenders, Scott Duffy, similar victim preference, but different MOs? I can't reconcile those posed versus those not. What say you, Scott Duffy?
You have to. And investigators have to keep an open mind. You don't want to go down a rabbit hole. And that's what the defense looks for. Hey, once you locked in on my client, you ceased looking elsewhere where the evidence was pointing. If the evidence is pointing towards somebody, you go in that direction. If it's going to point against, then you go in the direction it's taking you. So, you know, I'll withhold judgment, but I do, you know, the Atlantic City homicides are a little bit different. They are similar in the sense that they are sex workers. They are exploited victims, And so you do have that similarity, and thereby it's a name now to add. But the investigation there had some similarities with, New York, not in the sense of police corruption, but just in the sense of probably a commander was trying to, whether in the prosecutor's office, just trying to have everything dealt with separately, as opposed to, hey, we have four victims, relatively close proximity, and let's look at this as one person. All these spots are tourist spots. So if somebody's angle is, hey, we don't want to sound the alarm and scare away our tourists, so look at it, and you actually hurt the investigation, that has a tendency to set you back. But I'm hopeful that there are key pieces of evidence that they've had, just like New York, and now that they have a point of reference, they'll be able to do some quick comparisons to either go further or closer to, to their suspect, or to rule it out and say, hey, we're in a different direction. So I totally agree with that statement. I mean, you always have to look at the fact that it could be something else, and no different than, the other statement. Hey, we have a brother. And what do we know about the brother? And so, these are good questions.
And Atlantic City was very quick to dismiss any connection to Rex Heuermann. They already came out early on to say that. I don't know if that's the end of that story. I'm cynical. Shout out to Tiff Knox, Chelsea Whitaker, Misdemeanor, who says victims in Las Vegas and Atlantic City didn't have burlap bags on our bodies, did they? I don't believe they did. Also, a shout out to Sally Vella. Mac, go for it.
Well, I would just remind them about Ted Bundy and Israel Keyes. Ted Bundy bludgeoned people to death with a log. He strangled people with their own pantyhose. He beheaded some of his victims, not all of them. And then out of the blue, virtually out of nowhere, he kidnaps and rapes and murders a 12-year-old little girl. So if you were to take his crimes, it doesn't look like the same person either. Israel Keyes did the same thing. He kidnaps a young woman. He attacks her. He chops her up and throws her in the ice water. Then another young girl he takes and ties her up and puts out, a wanted find me poster in a state park and, baits her family and is having this weird thing where he puts a photograph out there for family to find, and it looks like he's ransoming her and she's alive, but at closer look, they realize she's not alive at all, that her eyes are, sewn weird, and he's got makeup on her and he's posed her. So again, killers can change. They can, add to their toolbox. They can, change things up a little bit. So when you've got four victims all lined up, they're all sex workers, they're all petite, they're all Caucasian, they're all, got similar hair and makeup and all that, then, it's hard for me to dismiss that. It's hard for me not to look at that and say, wait a minute, there's too many similarities, even though a killer can have zero similarities. So again, for me, everybody makes this backboard until I have a reason to rule them out and put them on somebody else. Is there any DNA? Is there any clothing that maybe they weren't last seen in? I'm captivated by the Asian male. Most of the victims are nude, if not all of them, except for him. So again, where did his clothes come from? Was he a cross-dresser? Was he, is that something he purchased? Was that something he was known to wear? Or did those clothes not fit him and they belong to Melissa or somebody else? Again, we don't know yet. And Scott made the perfect point. If you don't know how this stuff fits, you don't get rid of it. And one of my mantras is, I don't tell the evidence what happened. The evidence tells me what happened. So you want to be real clear that you're not getting tunnel vision. And that's the reason folks like Scott and Joe Scott Morgan are a gift to me. Because if I feel like, oh man, I think I know what this is, he's mad at sex workers because they bring the property value down. And if enough of them get involved with their area, then drugs get in there, then other crime gets in there, and the property value of that building goes straight down and maybe they ruin one of his buildings. Scott may say to me, Max, slow down. You're way out here. And he will keep me grounded. And I go, you know what? It popped in my head and I said it, just like facing north. It popped in my head. I said it, but I rely on a team. And I think what I have seen, and I would love for Scott to jump in, but from what I have seen, what they have done in Long Island, spectacular police work. Spectacular.
I'm going to have Scott jump in. The quote to take home from the night, I don't tell the evidence what happened. The evidence tells me what happened. You can quote Mac on that one. And I am not T-Pain, a friend of the show. Echoing what you were just saying, Max, serial killers can change their M.O. They don't always have to keep the same M.O. A big shout out to Black Widower, come to us from the U.K., devoted to Mariah Ketchup, who is formerly in South Florida and now in, I believe, North Carolina or South Carolina, one of the two. But if you're in South Carolina, got to keep a swivel on that head, Ketchup, anywhere you are. Scott Duffy, to you, very kind of macro question here. Hypothetically, you are the lead investigator on this case, but now your old bureau, the FBI, has got to be involved. How do you manage this? I don't know why I'm so fixated on this, but how do you manage a case like this with so many different states, jurisdiction, beds, state, local? How do you even begin? Pull back the curtain for us.
Okay, so every jurisdiction is its own. So Gilgo Murders, Suffolk County, is honed in on what they have. They're not interested. It doesn't mean they don't care. They're not interested in everything else surrounding because they have to make sure, especially now that they have an arrest, that clock is ticking. And so, you know, you have the three murders. I know we keep hearing the likelihood of the fourth. And then, of course, we know there are more victims who have been uncovered. So thereby, it's going to just continue to grow. So each and every, let's just say each and every area, you have Atlantic City, you have South Carolina, Nevada. So each and every area will have, my guess, a task force and a prosecutor assigned to that task force with a mixture of entities, federal, state, and local. And so they are doing their job as if the others didn't exist. But they will share information. Perhaps they will even meet together in more of a powwow. And so it will be those who have already completed something. Hey, this is what I have, and I'm willing to share it if it helps you. Either look closer at our suspect, or look further away, or whatever have you. So that's ultimately, even though this is somewhat of a monster in the sense that it covers both coasts and et cetera, the individual jurisdictions are not concerning themselves, but they are more than willing to share what they have with each other to assist in that way. So in that regard, you really just look at it as what do we have? So New York is doing whatever they have, going through that war room, going through checking off their lists, and a lead investigator responsibility is ensuring that, for example, we use black and red. Black, it is completed, and the red ink, it's something that needs to be completed. And then you prioritize. And the lead investigator's job is to come in, look at the board, and ensure that everything is getting done, and making assignments. And then staying on top of once the assignment is done, he or she cannot be too concerned with every interview, every evidence that's going to be processed. She's going to go to the board and say, okay, so we have a check mark. Let me take a look. Let me review it, make sure it's documented. And now it goes into a case file. And so that's ultimately how I would imagine that they are getting this completed. And then every once in a while, when things slow down, it will be, okay, what else do we have out there that's a possibility? And is there something we can share to help another case advance? That's how it's going.
And Scott, how often are they having these like big meetings of the minds where they all sit around together and say, hey, you know, we think this might be the next step. That might be the next step. Is that once a week? Is it every day? Once every 2 weeks? How often are they having these big meetings?
So with regards to the task force itself or the big broader?
I mean, broader than that. I mean, because the task force must be speaking to, you know, the feds too, right? So I assume they all get on a conference call or Zoom at some point. But is it frequent or is it just when something comes up?
I would say early on, it's frequent. So definitely when the task force was made, and I haven't heard of a total number of actual investigators from the federal, state, and local entities that were made up with this for this task force. But you, and I remember reading something where one of the agencies wanted to make sure that, hey, in order for this to be pure, in order for this to be free from all the other items in the past that have gone wrong, whether it be public corruption, whether it be the Chief Burke going down this personal, avenue with his own problems. And so the task force is making sure everybody's new, everybody is on board, everybody's going to be able to get along, and most importantly, be able to trust each other, that there's not information flying out that's going to be an obstacle. So my guess is they are meeting regularly in a offsite, whatever that location has been chosen ahead of time, and everything leading up to the arrest. Then you start to have, okay, now let's start to look at it as a prosecution of what we have, because the clock is ticking. And then, of course, the unsolved. You still have victims that need to be identified. Genealogy is definitely going to be playing a role. And they probably have given that, if not to the FBI, to the state police crime labs in order to say, hey, this is something that we want a deadline on. With the advancement of technology and so forth, you'll definitely be able to put a deadline onto that. And that's up to the supervisors to ensure that deadlines are being met and that resources are being provided in order to get those deadlines met. So the big task force probably met somewhat regularly leading up to an arrest, especially, I think it was soon after the task force was formulated that they were given the information of a possible suspect and they honed in. But all this other stuff that's going around the country, that's up to those individual jurisdictions to make a connection before they can really, get invited to this big table.
Speaking of genealogy, last night we were doing the Rachel Morin story, the mother of five on the Maryland Trail. We have the godmother of investigative genetic genealogy, Barbara Rae Venter. She cracked open the Golden State Killer case. And as far as I know, she hasn't been contacted regarding this case, but I wouldn't be surprised if she was. But it sounds like they are already, I'm sure, knee deep in trying to figure out, DNA trees and family trees, things of that nature. I'm throwing out I do create a rundown, believe it or not. That's a news term, kind of something to follow the show. It's what I use to kind of create the framework of the show, and I'm throwing it away because they're good questions. So Lucy Bell, Mac, I'll take a couple more questions from SDS Nation, and we'll wrap her up. I don't believe removal of shoes was a foot fetish. I believe it was more a symbol, a cleansing, and ritual before killing, more akin to biblical inferences, as with the burlap, which Joe Scott was speaking of, followed by this comment from Texas Mess, sackcloth and timeout dolls, repentance and shame. Mac, this gets creepy and weird. Do you think there's something to this, that there's some kind of biblical implication in all this, and maybe Rex read the Bible and that's what's going on here?
Again, I'm going to go back to the belt, spare the rod, right? He incorporated that with everything that he could possibly use. That's what he incorporated, a personal item from a male father figure in his life. I mean, to me, you don't ignore that. How it fits, maybe we don't know yet. But I agree that if you look at what they have released so far, he ain't talking about feet. He ain't looking at feet, right? So I'm going to take his research that I know he looked up. And that to me is what's paramount. He wanted to rape. He wanted to torture. He didn't care if it was women, men, children. He's a perverted rapist killer. That's what he is. And he can't hide that. He hadn't hid it. There are people, I guarantee you, he went to school with that thought he was a creep. People in high school thought he was a creep. People in his office think he's a creep. His neighbors think he's a creep. Again, he can't hide it. He is who he is. It is rare that somebody can get to this level of perversion and not show it in everything they do. It's on his phone. It's on his computer. I guarantee you, in that house, there are maps. There are codes. He has his own code system where he can interpret it only. I guarantee it. He kept things. And I'm going to go back to this because I haven't heard anybody else talking about it. There's one bin they took out of that house, and it was of a Playboy magazine inside of it. If you looked at it, it was in pristine condition. It looks to me, if you Google it, like the 1987 Marilyn Monroe Playboy. 1987, and it's in perfect condition. Again, that tells you what's important to him. He don't know where his marriage license is, but he knows where that magazine is. You follow me? Yeah. Men will tell you what is important to them by what they spend their money on and what they spend their time on. So I tell single women all the time, you want to date somebody that plays golf 9 times a week, do not come to me 2 weeks after you've been married talking about, he just plays golf all the time. You knew that, sugar. That's him. That's what he wants to do. If, on the other hand, all he wants to do is fix up the house and dote on you and play with the kids, okay, cool. That's where he wants to spend his time. But they will tell you. They won't hide it. It ain't like you're going to be married for 2 years and go, I didn't know you liked SEC football. Yes, you did. You couldn't even get married in the fall. My husband and I, we had to get married on a bye week. I'm just telling you. So I don't need to tell people I didn't know he enjoyed college football. Of course, they will tell you. And you two are men. Y'all know I'm telling the truth.
Yeah, you 100%. Know it. That there's actually a lot of comments in the chat that I don't want to necessarily get into it tonight, but people who are implying or just outright saying that the wife probably knew what was up, not necessarily about the murders, but at least with the prostitution.
Well, here's another thing, y'all. Look how fast she processed that information to want a divorce. I'm not blaming her. I'm not saying she knew anything. You could know your husband is a cheating, no good SOB, but you will not leap to think that he is killing people. Okay. But again, you look at Delphi, where the wife in that case is standing by him. It takes a minute for people to accept what you're telling them when it's just unbelievable. What did it take her? 3 days? And she was getting a divorce? Well, that tells me there was a base of understanding.
Smart. Very, very smart observations. Tiff Knox, smart as well. Just don't pick your guest's noses, Joel. That would be weird. I would have to agree with that assessment. Brianna Cece. Scott Duffy, this is an interesting question on a very macro level once again. Why so many unusual suspects this year? Seems like we just, you know, obviously Brian Koberger comes to mind. There's unfortunately a gazillion others. Is it just in your opinion that there's this instant information? We've got Twitter, we've got social media, we have YouTube, we've got the cable news shows. Is it just that we have such access to information, or has crime gotten stranger in recent years? Or has it always been this way, Scott Duffy?
It seems like in my world, it's always been. this way. But I feel there is a not just an uptick in crime stats, but in generally speaking, and in some of my classes, I'll discuss it just seems like in the last 3-4 years, people in general just are less patient and so forth. And I've noticed even talking amongst my law enforcement circles of just how much like there's not just an increase in these bizarre crimes, but an increase in just everyday, you know, road rage incidents and whatnot, that these things exist. I couldn't tell you why, but it does. And I would imagine the social media and platforms that are growing as also information is instant, as opposed to sitting in a war room, worried about my own investigation, and then maybe hearing through, you know, a law enforcement bulletin, you know, very specific avenue of information where it's like, hey, there's something else that you may want to be interested in. So now it just seems like, you know, and I think this is also good in the sense that there's lots of information there with regards to these type of crimes happening, and people have an interest in understanding it and providing their own, analysis of what it could be or who it could be, and et cetera. So perhaps the world is so big, and now it seems like it's not so big, very provincial in regard to where, you know, perhaps we'll see people being caught quicker. I'm not so sure. We'll, you know, with all this media attention, you would think somebody who's thinking of becoming a serial killer would be like, okay, I better not use a phone. I better get off the grid, like Max said. You know, it's, they can't help themselves. It's human nature. It's laziness. It's you know, don't go across the world, or, you know, so to speak, to get rid of evidence. Just throw it out in your backyard or just a couple of miles. It's so the short answer to your question is I do think there is an uptick in the strangeness of crimes. It seems like something is happening that calls for some research.
The legendary Art Bell of Coast to Coast used to call it high strangeness. Cece here says we're going to wrap it up in 1 second. I think Rex thought it was a girl about the Asian man. And when he found out it was a man, he got peed off and killed him. I didn't see Ski Hat Sarah, now Ski Hatless Sarah. She says, I feel like the pandemic has changed people. I definitely do. This is my favorite question of the night because I used to work there. Cable news, ? Does that even still exist? I love it because if you knew some of the people I knew, they think that they're Tom Cruise and whoever is a big actress. People don't even watch cable news. So Penelope Austin, Mac is a Southern Belle with an Einstein brain. She is also an Emmy Award winning CSI, the real CSI, not that stuff you see on TV. Part of CBS 46. She's a writer for Crime Online. She's the director of the Cold Case Investigative Research Unit. She does stuff with Nancy Grace. She works for the Metro Atlanta Police Department. She holds a master's degree in criminal justice. She's the co-author of the textbook Cold Case Pathways to Justice. Mac, what's the next big shoe to drop in this case, if you had to guess? I mean, I think earlier you said you think we're going to get Peach's identity. Yeah. By the way, she's the host of Zone 7, most importantly. So watch and listen to that podcast.
Yeah, I think for sure the next big thing is going to be Peach's being identified and then the Asian male. And I want to speak to him just a second. That's the reason I said this timeline, this board up in the war room is so critical, because Rex researched Asian Tinks. I want to know if he did that before that victim was found, because that's going to tell you that was something he was interested in. If not, then yeah, it could be that he was, you know, boonswoggled, but I doubt it. I think he, again, he knows what he's doing. This is something that he has not done 10 minutes. He is an expert at reaching out to sex workers to get them to respond, to get them to agree to do things that people will not do with their spouse or girlfriend or a one-night stand. These are not people that are, you know, spending a week courting somebody, for lack of a better word, to meet them in a secret place, to pay them money, to do missionary position. All y'all got to do is spend one afternoon, just type in fetishes. You won't be able to finish 2 hours. I'm just telling you. And if you work in our business and you work any time in vice, what people ask people to do sexually, you'll just be left going, what? How is that even sexual? How is a bolt lock sexual? But to somebody it is. So again, a lot of money is made because people will not ask the person in their life to do something. So I'm just saying, the other thing that I want to make clear, there's been a couple of folks that have come out and said that he gave them such a bad feeling that their gut told them, do not get in the car with this man. Now, I want to be perfectly clear with y'all. These women are asked to do things that you would find so revolting that they do them, and they're asked to do them. So if they say to you, I would not get in that man's car, I'm telling you again, this person is on a different level.
Somehow, whatever Max says just sounds so eloquent. I don't have that problem. Horsey Tara says, wife had to be conscious and unconsciously know he's weird. I agree with that. People like to stick their head in the sand. I agree with that. To survive, I highly doubt she knew of the murders. I would tend to agree with all of that. Jenny Meow Meow, shout out to her. I feel like our society has developed anxiety and a short temper. I think I developed that when I was like 3, due to constant fear and outrage from the news cycle. And I got to tell you, I think there's something to that. I was in that business for over 25 years. And fear sells. It does. And I don't know how intentional it always is, but you turn on the news and it's not usually something too positive. The man who's always positive, Scott Duffy, is the director of Wilmington University's Criminal Justice Institute, an FBI special agent out of the Delaware office, great glasses, and a Commonwealth of PA police officer for 5.5 years. Scott, let's end on a happy note. You teach kids who are studying criminal justice. Are these kids boneheads, or do we have a good future ahead of us?
No, we have a great future. And the past 5 years I've been teaching in a college setting, I've just come across that vast amount of awesome thinkers. And it's nice to see them in the classroom, and we have great discussions, and I'm looking forward to the fall. So a whole new set of thinkers coming through.
And my suggestion, and this is none of my business, but I think one day you zoom in Mac for your students. She's a real life crime scene investigator, and we tie the proverbial ribbon and bow. We bring it all together. So that's just my humble suggestion. Quick programming note. Tomorrow, 12:30 p.m. Eastern, for our global audience, there's a doctor named Dr. Devin Hoover. He was shot in the head twice and wrapped into a carpet in a mansion in Detroit. He's a neurosurgeon, and the case has gone unsolved. And tomorrow, 12:30 p.m. Eastern time, we've got none other than the former Detroit police chief, James Craig, coming on, and awesome. A bright mind. So 12:30 p.m. Eastern tomorrow. Then Thursday, 7 p.m. Eastern, Detective Phil Ramos is coming back with Lieutenant Lisa Daddio from the New Haven Police Department to discuss, is there a possible serial killer in Missouri? This is a twisted case near Kansas City. Guy had a woman tied up with a dog collar. She escaped when this guy took his own kid to school. She thought that other people were killed. And guess what? At least one woman has turned up in a blue barrel in the water, and now police think they may have a serial killer on their hands. It's a story we're going to dig into Thursday night, and then Friday it's going to be a recorded broadcasting. No show Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or Monday, but we're going to have Surviving My Biggest Case as I get dragged to a wedding once again halfway across the country. Until then, more than halfway, three quarters. Love you, America. Love you, Georgia. Love you, Delaware, Pennsylvania. Love you, Maui.